This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. 4 months after tragedy struck Newtown, Connecticut, the region experienced another tragedy. 1 year ago today, thousands of runners took to the streets for the 117th Boston Marathon. Many didn't reach their destination after two bombs exploded near the finish line. These explosions killed and maimed and set off a frantic series of events, a search for loved ones, a mass unit on Boylston Street, a massive manhunt that shut down the city. Today, Where We Live, a look back at the Boston Marathon bombings and the days that followed. Coming up, we'll hear from an amateur radio operator working at the finish line at the time of the blasts, and from a local professor who finished the race just minutes before the bombs went off. But first, in the days after the bombings, as WNPR did its own coverage of the events, we checked in with our next guest. Alex Ashlock is WBUR's longtime Boston Marathon reporter and is a producer for Here and Now. Alex, welcome back to Where We Live.
Thank you, John.
So first of all, what is today's tribute going to look like in Boston?
Well, the tribute today will feature Vice President Joe Biden. You might remember that in the days after the bombings last year, President Barack Obama came to a memorial service. Vice President Joe Biden will be here today. He's the final speaker in a program that will also include remarks by some of the survivors of the marathon bombing. Governor Deval Patrick will speak. Former Mayor Tom Menino and the current mayor of Boston, Marty Walsh, will also be speaking today. And I think the service will obviously remember as well the people who were killed in the bombings a year ago today. Martin Richard, he was 8 years old from Dorchester. Crystal Campbell, 29 years old. And Liu Lingzi, a graduate student from China who was attending Boston University. Those were the three people killed in the bombings last year.
How is this anniversary date resonating in the city? It's unusual to have an event where we mark an anniversary of a tragedy, and then just a few days later, we mark the anniversary a second time when the race is run once again. Tell me a bit about the mood right now.
Well, it's interesting. I was in the city over the weekend at the finish line. There was a photo shoot for Sports Illustrated. They wanted to get people together at the finish line to take a different kind of picture than was on the magazine cover last year after the bombings. You might remember that photo. It was taken by John Tulamaki of the Boston Globe. It shows a runner lying on the ground. It shows three Boston police officers reacting. It was taken right in the moment after the first bomb exploded. One police officer has her gun drawn, another one reaching for his gun. It's a picture of chaos. And what they wanted to do on Saturday was take a picture that showed that Boston is ready to run the race again. And the feeling downtown on Saturday was a lot like it is on the Saturday before the actual race. It felt like people were excited and in anticipating the race. Lots of people down there were going to be running in the marathon. So there was a lot of energy on Saturday. But today, I think you are hitting the pause button on that energy in a way to take an hour or so to remember what happened last year on this day and also to remember the people who responded to that horrible event when those two bombs went off. So today, I think the mood is somber. It's a little bit drizzly here in Boston on this April 15th. Last April 15th was a beautiful day, but I think the weather today maybe is emblematic of the mood in Boston. It's a day of reflection and remembrance.
One of the reasons you love covering this is because you love the sport of running. Tell me what the runners, the people who are going to take part in this marathon, have been saying to you about their experience throughout this last year and how they feel going into another marathon.
Well, they're very excited about running the race again, and they want race day to come because it's been a year since the bombings. But they're also saying that this anniversary, some of them are saying this to me, that this anniversary is bringing back all the bad memories of that day. So many runners were crossing the finish line when the bombs went off, when the first bomb and the second bomb went off. You know, those people are going to be always affected by what happened. Thousands of other people were running the race, and they were forced to stop, and they had no idea what had happened because the information just wasn't coming to them. So many of them are coming back to run this year. So the bad memories are there, but also for the runners, again, they're looking forward to Monday's 118th Boston Marathon. Their training this year has been maybe extra special because of what happened last year. And also, I think especially, John, for the people who are running for charity, Especially, there's this team called Team MR8. It was organized in support of Martin Richard, that little boy who was killed at the finish line. It's a foundation they're raising money for, and it's almost raised $1 million in the year since the bombings. And for those folks, it's extra special, and it says, and what they've been telling me is that running the race, even for people who have run the race, you know, 5 or 6 times, it's definitely meaning more this year in light of what happened last year and in light of what they're doing to help support the Martin Richard Foundation.
I think that's one of the interesting things that people often forget about a race like this, is that so many people are doing this not for the pure athletic competition of getting their best time or to do something that they want to cross off their bucket list. But many of the thousands of runners are running for someone else. Last year, we had people from Connecticut running in memoriam of the Newtown tragedy. And of course, they were victimized once again. This is a big part of what Boston's all about, Alex.
That's right. And I'm glad you brought Newtown up, because I remember what I usually do on marathon day is I'm on the radio here at WBUR previewing the race, and then I walk down to the finish line. It's a sort of a ritual, and I remember walking by the special Newtown banner that was right at the 26-mile mark of the marathon in downtown Boston, and I was thinking about those terrible events as well. And as you say, the people from Newtown who were running in the marathon last year had a second tragedy to deal with when the bombings happened. So yes, it's a big part of the Boston Marathon, the charity experience, and people running in memory of other people they've lost. There are people raising money for cancer. There are people raising money for liver research. And I have to say, this year, I live right on the marathon course in Natick, and it seems like I've seen more people training on the marathon course this year than I've ever seen before. And a couple of weeks ago, a lot of people did their final long runs, and I had never seen so many people on the Boston Marathon course except on a race day. It was really unbelievable.
We're talking with Alex Ashluck, who's a producer for NPR's Here and Now, but he's also been the longtime Boston Marathon reporter for member station WBUR in Boston. He helped us with our coverage of the marathon bombings, which happened 1 year ago today. We've heard a bit about the security that's going to be in place on Monday. What's the latest? What can you tell us about how things will be different at this year's marathon, Alex?
Well, it's a 26.2-mile course, so it's very difficult to secure all that mileage. But there will be more police officers on duty on Monday. There will be more undercover officers on duty. There will be more cameras watching the course, and this will be especially true in downtown Boston. You might remember it was surveillance video that really showed us the first pictures of the bombing suspect. So authorities are going to have more cameras out. They're asking people, they're discouraging people from bringing backpacks and large bulky items to the marathon. You're not prohibited from bringing backpacks, but they are discouraging it and saying that if you do have items like that, you know, you will be searched or you might be subject to being searched. There will be security checkpoints along Boylston Street in downtown Boston, Boylston Street being where the marathon finish line is. And that's something that's really never been seen before, having to pass through some kind of security checkpoint to get downtown. It's very crowded downtown during the marathon. So what police are saying is your best bet in terms of getting downtown quickly is to just not really bring anything with you. The city is ramping up emergency medical services for Monday. The Boston Marathon itself, the organizers will have bigger medical tents at the finish line. And last year, you know, the medical people at the Boston Marathon, I mean, you couldn't have been in a more perfect position to deal with the sort of carnage you saw after those bombings if you hadn't had people that were well-versed in the medical world who were right there, you know, 15, 20 yards away from the finish line, and they really helped. So all of those things are being ramped up this year. And it's not just because of what happened on this day a year ago. It's not just because of the bombings. It's also because there will be 36,000 runners in this year's race. That's 9,000 more than last year. The Boston Athletic Association increase the size of the field because so many people want to run the race on Monday, since it's the first one since the bombing. So officials are having to deal with a huge increase in the field size. So that's another reason why all these items, security, medical, more volunteers in general. That's why all those things are being bumped up this year.
And Alex, I've been thinking a lot about you in the days leading up to this, because you love this race. You've covered this race for many years, and you both wrote and you spoke very emotionally about its impact on you last year. You've had a year to digest all this. What are you thinking about on this anniversary?
I guess I'm thinking about why I love the race so much, and why what has happened here has had such a big impact on me. And I think it's because of people. You know, I think about the people who were killed. I didn't know any of them personally. I didn't know, or I don't know, any of the survivors personally. But I know so many people who have run the Boston Marathon. I know so many people who are running the race again this year. I know the people that are organizing the marathon. I know people who are in the medical tent every year. I know people who were in the medical tent last April 15th who saw horrible things on Boylston Street. I know a doctor who helped save lives at Boston Medical Center, although in some cases he couldn't save the limbs of the people who were brought to BMC that day. So I think, as I think about the anniversary, I'm thinking about all the other people who probably feel a little bit like me today. It's a very emotional day, and I think this tribute at the Heinz Convention Center this afternoon will be an extremely emotional event to be at and also to watch and listen to.
Alex Ashlock will be covering the tributes and memorials for WBUR, and then on Monday, on Marathon Day, he'll be doing what he always does. He'll be covering it for WBUR and then walking down to the finish line to see the runners finish. Alex, always good to speak with you, and have a very good day today, and enjoy race day on Monday.
Thank you, John.
Coming up later today on the Colin McEnroe Show, a conversation about resilience and how we bounce back. But first, some memories, and we want you to share yours. Call us at 860-275-7266 if you were a runner or a spectator last year, if you had someone you loved near the finish line, if you feel part of the Boston Strong movement that's defined the city for this past year. Give us a call, 860-275-7266. Coming up after this break, we'll hear from an amateur radio operator who was working at the finish line at the time of the blasts, and from a local professor who finished the race just minutes before the bombs went off. You can also email us wherewelive at WNPR.org or tweet us at wherewelive. This is Where We Live.
Your resolve is the greatest rebuke to whoever committed this heinous act. If they sought to intimidate us, to terrorize us, to shake us from those values that Deval described, the values that make us who we are as Americans, well, it should be pretty clear by now that they picked the wrong city to do it.
That's President Barack Obama speaking at a memorial to remember the victims of the Boston Marathon bombings, which happened 1 year ago today. Today in the city of Boston, Vice President Joe Biden, along with Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick and others, will be there in a memorial tribute. We're going to be talking about this throughout the day here on WNPR. At 1 o'clock, the Colin McEnroe Show talks about resilience, how we bounce back from events like this. In just a moment, we'll be bringing in Ann Starr from the Boston Public Library. We want to hear from you at 860-275-7266. If you have memories of being in Boston last year at this time, if you're a runner who's going to run in this year's race, we'd love to hear your voice. 860-275-7266. We just heard from Alex Ashlock, the reporter from WBUR, who covers the Boston Marathon every year. And of course, he covered these tragic events last year. He was talking a lot about the medical tent, the personnel who were at the finish line. One of those people was Harold Kramer. He's chief operating officer of the American Radio Relay League. He's a volunteer amateur radio operator who was helping with communications at last year's Boston Marathon. He talked to us last year on this day. And Harold, welcome back to Where We Live. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome, John.
Could you remind us, Harold, where you were when the bombs went off?
I was at the entrance of the medical tent, facing Boylston Street. When the runners come down Boylston Street, if they don't need medical attention, they can go straight and meet their family. But if they need any kind of help, they would turn to the right and enter the medical tent.
And who all was in the medical tent that day?
Oh, lots of people, hundreds of doctors and nurses and runners and volunteers. Just, it was pretty packed. It's about a block long. It's not really a tent, you know. It's a plastic building built out of a metallic structure, but it is about a block long. This is medical tent A. There are two medical tents.
And it's filled with all these doctors and medical technicians because, at the end of a 26.2-mile race, there are a lot of people who need medical attention. They're there to care for people who've just been through a very grueling race.
Yes, it's quite an elaborate setup. I think there are 20 stations with different specialties, everything from podiatry to family relations to chiropractic to cardiology. There were strings along the aisles for ICU. There was an in-house pharmacy. When runners come in, their barcode gets scanned. Their medical history would pop up on a screen. There was a triage doctor at the entrance of the tent who would quickly evaluate the runner and send him to the right position.
Why were you there?
I was a volunteer amateur radio operator. Part of my job with two other people, three people in my team, was to provide communications for Chris Troianos. Chris is the medical director of the Boston Marathon. And the three of us, even though he took some kidding as his entourage, provided communications. I provided communications back to network control. Ralph, one of the other folks, provided communications back to medical. And Jeremy, the other person on our team, had a radio that connected him to the Massachusetts Emergency Operations Center.
And the communications, of course, is very important. I'm going to get to the communications in the moments after the blast in just a moment. But just recall for us the moment that the bombs went off and what was happening in that medical tent. What happened with you and all the others of hundreds of people who didn't at that point know what was happening?
Well, like I said, the tent was very crowded. The race runners were coming in all the time. There's a corridor down the center of the tent, sort of like a long bowling alley that the runners can go down after they're triaged. I was standing with the rest of the team near the front of the tent, sort of behind Chris. That was our protocol. If Chris needed one of us to talk to somebody on the course or to medical or to the EOC, that was our job. And we were just standing there a few minutes before. I was talking to Dr. Bagish, who was the cardiologist, and he was telling me, this has been a great race. I remember what he said. He said, if it's good weather, it's a good race. There weren't the medical heat problems from the year before. And I was standing there. We heard this thud. It's the only way to describe it. And the tent physically shook a bit. You could feel the vibration. And everybody kind of looked at each other and said, you know, what was that? Did someone fire a cannon? Chris just looked at the three of us and started sprinting out the door. And then smoke started rolling in to the tent. And it smelled like that smell of sulfur and gunpowder. And then we heard a second explosion, at which point our communications team was broken up. Ralph went to try and follow Chris. Jeremy went out to see what was going on, and I said I would stay inside to keep track of everybody else. The amateur radio that I was wearing in my headset, there were lots of communications coming through. We had our own private intercom channel as well as our other communications channel. And the question at that point was, what is going on? What just happened? We don't know.
Well, and this is one of the things that our guest later on in the program, Jeff Martin, who is a runner in the race, he experienced along with many others. There was a difficulty in communication in the moments afterward and really in the hours afterward. There wasn't a lot of information that was available. The information that was there was garbled. People were trying to make cell phone calls. Those weren't easy to come by. Explain a little bit from the communications person on the ground what we knew, what we didn't know, what communications was really available at that point.
Well, I was responsible for amateur radio, and amateur radio uses about 200 operators at this event in three groups, start, course, where I was the year before, and finish. I was in the finish line team, and all I could hear was, okay, what's going on? We're not quite sure. Does anybody have any information? We were not the professional communicators. The first 20 minutes, having spoken to some of the professional first responders, was pretty crazy on communications. You're right. The cell network overloaded. The text network was working. I could send a text. And the radio networks really just were not coordinated well the first 15 or 20 minutes. After about 10 minutes, I was able to contact Amateur Radio Network Control, who said, amateur radio operators, please leave the medical tent. Stand down. Join us at Network Control, which was on Copley Square. So I walked over there, and I still didn't know what was going on. I looked on my smartphone, and I was able to see on CNN that there was a terror attack at the Boston Marathon. And that's the first time I really knew what was going on. I saw injured people coming into the tent while I was standing there, which was not a pleasant thing to experience. Mm. But then I left the tent and I went over and I helped the guys at bus dispatch. The buses, there's 26 buses on the marathon. I believe that's the number. And the runners who had already arrived used those buses to get transportation back to the start line.
Because it's very important. This race starts in Hopkinton, in Mass, and it goes for 26 miles into the city. It's unlike marathons run in almost any other city, which is around in circles. The finish line is near the start line. Here, these buses need to be coordinated to get people back to the start. We're talking with Harold Kramer, who's chief operating officer of the American Radio Relay League. He was in the medical tent at the moment of the Boston Marathon bombings last year. We're hearing some of his remembrances, and we're going to take some of yours in a moment as well at 860-275-7266. We'd like to know what impact the Boston Marathon bombing had on you, whether you had loved ones there last year, if you're a runner who plans to run again this year. We'd love to hear your stories. 860-275-7266. 2 weeks after the Boston Marathon bombings, WBUR's Meghna Chakrabarty visited a pop-up memorial in Copley Square. She spoke with some people who were visiting the memorial, including Charlie Monahan from Braintree, Massachusetts.
You don't take away our runs. You just don't. I'm sorry, it's just not done. I think you folks will agree with me. I ran Boston last year. I'm going to try to get a bid this year. I'm 100% disabled Vietnam vet. The last 10, and I'm 73 now. I'm totally amazed how my thinking has just done a 180 as to humanity. It's part of my problem all these years is Vietnam, and I've seen people at their worst. I've now officially seen people at their best.
Voices gathered by WBUR's Meghna Chakrabarty last year at the pop-up memorial in Copley Square. I want to bring in Ann Starr, who's project manager for the project Dear Boston, Messages from the Marathon Memorial. It's an exhibition at the Boston Public Library. Ann, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
I'm wondering if you can tell us about the Marathon Memorial and the messages that you gathered for this exhibit.
Well, actually, there were a lot of different messages. We realized pretty quickly in looking through the materials that are stored at the Boston City Archives that there were a number of objects that had things written on them. And we found, maybe 15 or 20 different, we found patterns. So there were about 15 or 20 different messages that seemed to repeat over and over again. Many of them were, love for Boston, people, talking about how Boston is their home. There was a number of things that said, we stand with Boston, and those were from all over the world. There were a lot of messages from runners. One of the things that really made this memorial unique was the number of pairs of shoes, and many of them had something written on them, either about running or to runners in a language that runners speak. And then there were the thing that we were focusing on was all of the sort of forward-looking messages, messages of hope and love and solidarity for the city of Boston.
Hmm. Let's listen to another voice from WBUR. This is, again, reporter Meghna Chakrabarty visiting the memorial site in Copley Square, speaking with some visitors there.
Hi, my name's Alicia Lawton, and I live in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It's tragic. I know victims, and I work as a nurse, so I've had experience with the victims, and it's just, I don't know, it's impossible to really kind of put your mind around all the human suffering, and I don't know, there's just really no way to describe it, but I've never been more proud in my life to be a resident here because the people really, truly came together and did everything that was necessary. And I think as a community, we're really going to heal from this. And this is where it all starts, Once all of this is gone, I think this is all going to be something that we keep in our hearts forever. And we're all going to learn from this experience. And no matter what, we're going to all be stronger for it.
Ann Starr, that voice is one of the messages that you're talking about here, about coming together as a community. And once again, that message of a community coming out of this stronger than it was before. It seems like this is one of the major themes here.
Yes, it is. We saw that basically a lot, this tragedy brought out the humanness in everyone. The human to human contact, and solidarity. To help everyone move forward and heal. We realize that people will be moving forward in a different way than perhaps they experienced right first when it happened on this first anniversary, and that's part of why we wanted to do this exhibit.
And I'm wondering, because we've been getting some personal reflections here, what your experiences were in the days following the bombing.
Actually, I have to admit that I was not at the marathon on the day of the bombing. I heard about the memorial. It actually started growing almost immediately after the bombing. I stayed for that first week. I stayed glued to the radio and the TV, to find news. I had been kind of reluctant to go down to the memorial, at first, because I felt like it might be disrespectful to go down and sort of be a tourist and say, here's this thing, I need to see it. And then a friend told me that she ended up there inadvertently. She'd been running errands in Boston and found herself driving across the finish line and past the burned out buildings. And when she described the experience of doing that, of seeing her city in a familiar way and an unfamiliar way, these really familiar places that just look so totally different, I said, I need to go down to that memorial and experience that. I was really surprised, when I went in, about the reverential feel in the memorial. It was less like a tourist attraction and more like church in the way that people were responding to it. And that really helped me sort of cope with what was happening and what had happened.
Why do you think memorials like this are so important? We've, of course, had to deal with this here in Connecticut in the aftermath of the Newtown tragedy, in which a number of memorials, both permanent and semi-permanent, have cropped up. Thousands upon thousands of letters and gifts sent to the town of Newtown. It helps in the healing process. It's also something that can, in many ways, extend a type of sadness after an event. I'm wondering if you can talk a bit, Anne, about why you think memorials like this are important, what they do for people.
Well, I think, at the very basic level, it helps people feel like they're doing something. In a situation like this where, most people really can't do anything or something like that, you feel like you're, letting those affected know that you're thinking of them and feeling for them. What's the first thing that you do when you hear that someone's sick or injured or something like that? You say, my thoughts are with you. And so that's kind of what, this is that on a giant scale, I think. It also, helps individuals process what has happened to them. One of the more poignant categories of objects that we found at the memorial are the ones from the people who were there. The gentleman who was speaking before me was talking about the people at the medical tent. And we have a number of posters and things made by people who were at the medical tent, and I think they have to say it helps them to process the experience and move forward.
Anne Starr's project manager for Dear Boston, Messages from the Marathon Memorial. It's an exhibition at the Boston Public Library. Anne, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you.
As we continue our conversation with Harold Kramer, who is a local resident, he's someone who's worked at the Boston Marathon in the past as an amateur radio operator. You were saying to me, Harold, that one of the things that a lot of these amateur radio folks had to do was get the message that something had happened and they had to stop runners. And we're going to hear from a runner in just a moment who was able to finish the race, but this must have been a very difficult thing to do, stop people who were so close to finishing something so important to them.
Yes, and after the explosion, amateur radio kept going with bus dispatch, very confused situation, where do all these buses go and where do all the runners go who are at the finish line who needed to be transported back to Hopkinton, all their clothes and stuff were in these big yellow bags. I don't know if you've ever seen it around Copley Square. And amateur radio operators on the course had to actually step out in the street and say, stop. You know, and most, I don't think most runners would probably believe that. You know, they might think this is some sort of crazy person telling them to stop the race. It was unprecedented.
Harold, we have just a minute or so left. Are you going to attend this year's race?
No, I'm not.
You're not?
No, I'm not. Lost my place to stay. My daughter's going to be at my house this year. She lives outside of Boston. I usually stay with her.
Given what happened, would you go back? Would you do this again and work on the marathon?
Yes, I would. Yes. I've now been at the network control. I've been on the course, and I've been at the finish line. I still have the start line to go. Maybe that's my next assignment.
Do you feel different a year later?
Yes, I do.
Tell me how.
Well, it's kind of hard to describe. I think there's two areas. One is emotionally, I think I value life a little more now. After seeing something like that, I have to consider myself really lucky. I was standing right where it went off, you know, maybe a couple hours before. I could have been right there. I think it's taken a little bit of a toll on me personally, thinking about things. I think, though, that I've learned a lot more about amateur radio emergency preparedness. Like we were talking about earlier, I've probably made 15, 20 speeches to amateur radio operators all over the country about what happened and how to be prepared.
And you've told this story, and so that's probably helped along in the process. Harold Kramer is an amateur radio operator and a former colleague here at WNPR. Thank you so much for sharing your stories once again.
You're welcome, John.
I really appreciate it. Coming up next, Quinnipiac University's Jeffrey Martin talks about his experience running the marathon last year, what he expects for the race coming up next week. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, it's our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. I'll be joined by a panel of reporters and news analysts to break down the week's news throughout Connecticut, from the race for governor to a burrito place. Yeah, you can join us coming up on the next Where We Live. Today, we're remembering the Boston Marathon bombings and the days that followed. Jeff Martin is an assistant professor of biomedical sciences at Quinnipiac University. Last year, he ran his first marathon in Boston. He crossed the finish line about 4 minutes before the bombs went off. Martin will try to bring things full circle when he runs in the marathon again next week. Jeffrey Martin, welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you.
Before we get to the events of last year and the bombing at the Boston Marathon, maybe you can explain your desire to run in this race. What got you to that point where you were running that race on that day last year?
I'm an exercise physiologist for work, and I'm always into athletic events. So the Boston Marathon has always been that one big bucket list goal thing that I wanted to do. And I actually met one of the medical directors for the race through work, and he indicated that he could get me an exemption to run the race. I'm not fast enough to qualify for the Boston Marathon. So he got me that exemption, and I was very excited to run in the race. So that's kind of how getting into the race came about for me last year. And I was lucky enough that we lived right off of mile marker number 17. So for training purposes, I could walk out of our apartment and be right on the marathon route to do my training.
And talk a bit more about that community of people who feel this race is important. I think that's it's a really important part of the story. It's a kind of holiday in New England. People from all over the region come to the race, not necessarily just to compete, but also to help, to volunteer, to cheer people on. What do you think this race means to the larger community of Boston and the surrounding area?
I think it's a celebration. I really do. I think it's a celebration of everybody. The amount of fun that people have, and I think the joy it brings to everybody in Boston is second to none. And the fact that it's on Patriots Day, you have the Red Sox game going on. I think it usually starts at 11 o'clock in the morning. So you have the Red Sox game, you have the marathon, and it's just an all-day-long celebration, I think, where everybody takes a day to really enjoy what Boston has to offer and what all these incredible people do. I mean, running a marathon is not easy, but, you know, it's the fact that people are raising money for charities. You have people volunteering their time to be out there to help the runners, to provide support on a number of different levels. So I really think it's a celebration of everybody. It's really an incredible experience.
Jeff Martin's an assistant professor of biomedical sciences at Quinnipiac University. He finished the Boston Marathon for the first time last year. He'll once again run the race next week. This is where we live. So take us through this day. As you say, you get an exemption to run. You're very excited. It's a bucket list for you. Before we get to the tragic events that ended that day, what was the race like for you, Jeff?
The race was one of the best days of my life. Everything shaped up perfectly. The weather was great. I think it was, in the mid-50s that day, which was perfect, in my opinion, for running. Partly cloudy, just from a weather perspective, it was fantastic. And I actually had a friend of mine that was running in the same wave as me, so we ran about the first 15 miles together, and I was just soaking it in. The atmosphere from mile zero to mile 26 is just nonstop fun and excitement, which is incredible. My wife has run marathons before, and they're nothing like Boston. So it was really unique. I took in every second I could. One thing I remember is it was around mile 15 or 16. There was a little kid standing, on the edge of the race route, and he had a single Dixie cup with his hand out, waiting for a runner to take it, and happened to be a perfect time because I needed a drink. And I remember taking that Dixie cup from him, and the way his face lit up, and he ran back to his mom and dad all excited to say, a runner took it. That was one of the things I remember most. That was a great moment. And then it continued to shape up perfectly. I'm a Red Sox fan, and right as I was at Cleveland Circle, the Red Sox had a walk-off hit to win the game, and that timed up perfectly so that when I ran by Kenmore Square, all the fans had poured out of Fenway Park, and they were elated about the game, and they came to the race route, and needless to say, it was very high energy at that point. So that was incredible, and, the feeling of rounding the corner to see the finish line, it's kind of a blur now, but it was an incredible feeling. It was an incredible accomplishment to cross the finish line, and I don't think that it really sank in for me, by the time that some of the events happened. But up until, the explosions, it was nearly a perfect day.
How long after you finished your marathon did the explosions occur?
It was about 4 minutes after, a little under 4 minutes after I crossed the finish line, the first explosion went off.
And so you were still very near the finish line when the bombs went off?
I was. I had actually seen a couple of students from where I worked at the finish line that were working as volunteers, and I said hello to them. And I had gotten, a water and a bag full of food that they provide you with, and I got my heat shield. And I was starting to make my way through the finisher's chute, and that's when the first bomb had gone off.
What was the first thing you thought of when these explosions happened?
I actually thought it was a steam pipe or something because, I heard it, I felt it, and when I turned around to look at what happened, you just saw a plume of white smoke, and, I thought maybe a steam pipe burst, and everybody was kind of confused, not sure what was happening, but, shortly thereafter, the second one went off, and that's when I had an inkling that something really wasn't right, and that's when I think some of the volunteers started to get some information through their walkie-talkies as to what was happening at the finish line there, and they started to do their best to take care of the situation.
A lot of people who had just finished the race were reunited with their families. You weren't exactly sure where your family was at that time. Tell me a bit about those hours between when the bombs went off and you learned what was going on and when you were actually able to find your family.
Sure. So I think I was in a strange group in the sense that everybody before the finish line, was redirected elsewhere. They were stopped and they were redirected. And everybody after me, I think, was cleared out of the family meeting area and redirected someplace else. But I was in a group of people where we didn't really get much direction as to where to go. And part of that may have been my own fault because I thought my wife, my parents were at the finish line, watching me finish. That was the plan. And I tried to get back toward the finish line, but nobody was allowing that to happen. So in my mind, I said, well, our plan is to meet at the family meeting area, so that's where I'm going, and then that's where I'm going to wait for my family because they know that's where we're supposed to meet. So I actually ran, despite the exhaustion of having just run a marathon, I ran all the way over to the family meeting area, And I stood there, and I waited and waited and waited to see my family. And I was there with probably, I would say, a dozen other runners. And, you know, one by one over time, I saw them reunite with their family. And I never saw my family. So I didn't know what was going on. There was a lot of misinformation being passed around from, you know, the folks that were standing there. I was trying to borrow cell phones from people to make calls, but calls weren't going through. You know, we later found out that they shut down cell phone service. A volunteer for the race had actually walked by, and I think they noticed that I wasn't doing too well. So they brought me into a nearby restaurant and, you know, got some warm clothes on me and started trying to facilitate, you know, some type of contact with my family. And they asked me for phone numbers for my wife or parents, and I gave them what I thought was my wife's cell phone number, which I know by heart, but I was so disoriented, I gave the wrong number. And they told me text messages were going through, so I had some hope, and, you know, there was no response, so we tried again, and again, when there was no response at that point, I was unfortunately thinking the worst, and I think that made things mentally, you know, much more difficult for me at the time. And probably another 5 or 10 minutes passed, and another volunteer came over and said, let's try one more time, and asked me for the phone number again. And I gave the number, and he looked at me and said, that's a different number than you gave last time. I said, oh, okay. I said, well, I think that's her number, so try it. And my wife responded within 30 seconds. So I went from thinking I had lost everything to realizing, you know, everything might be okay. And my wife was 2 blocks down the street with my parents, and they were trying to get to me, and the police wouldn't let them into that area, and I didn't know to leave the area I was in. So it was a long couple of hours, you know, but thankfully everybody was okay.
We're talking with Jeff Martin from Quinnipiac University. Last year he finished his first marathon, the Boston Marathon, and he'll run in this race once again in the town that he loves, Boston. This is where we live. I'm John Dankosky. Of course, you have a unique perspective being at the finish line right around the time of the bombing, but then you got to watch and wait with the rest of us as this manhunt for the Tsarnaev brothers went on, that included that late-night chase scene and more death and the eventual shutdown of a city until Johar Tsarnaev was found. What was that week like for you after having gone through this and then watching this city and this region that you love just be just gripped in this bizarre way that was frankly unlike anything I'd ever been through, anything I'd ever witnessed? It must have been, a very surreal experience.
It was. Surreal is a very good word. It was, you know, the night of the marathon, I think adrenaline carried me through a lot of things, and then just the joy of knowing my family was okay got me through that evening. But when I woke up the next morning, I think the impact and the weight of everything really hit me. And, you know, then the manhunt, I couldn't take my eyes away from the TV, and knowing that these guys were still out there, my wife was taking the T, you know, public transportation to and from work every day. And again, she's 7 months pregnant, and, you know, that's not usually something I have to worry about, but now I'm concerned about her being on public transportation. You know, is she safe? Is the city safe right now? And we lived in Newton. You know, as I said, we were right off of mile marker 17, and that wasn't far from where the suspects were eventually captured. So when that was all going on and they were telling people to stay in their homes and they had police out patrolling, that was our neighborhood. And, you know, you're hearing police on, you know, microphones telling you to stay in your homes and don't go outside. And it was amazing what had happened to my world and the area around me in a few days. You know, it went from being, you know, the greatest place on earth in our minds. We love Boston, to a very scary place to be.
One of the scary things, but also one of the very interesting and perhaps different things that came out of this was that reaction that the city had that seemed to suggest that it would be, in many ways, okay to just shut down, to stay inside until the perpetrators were caught. We've talked in preparing for this show that Boston may be the only community we can think of, and those of us who work on this program have lived many places in the U.S., it may be the only place where that type of reaction would have happened, where you could see a major American city just shut down and have people say, you know, we're gonna wait this out and make sure that this problem gets solved. Do you see Boston that way?
I do. It was incredible. I mean, there was cooperation on so many levels, from just the citizens staying off the streets to the servicemen and women that did so many things, you know, to finally capture these guys. I don't know that I would have predicted that would have happened, but looking back, it was an incredible show of strength for the city of Boston, and you know, I think the city has demonstrated its resolve. And I remember saying in the days thereafter, you know, I don't know if I would ever do the Boston Marathon again. I don't know if I would even go back to watch the Boston Marathon again because it was very fresh. But I think you saw that sentiment turn in the weeks after those guys were captured and saying that, you know, we're not going to let this affect who we are and what we do and what we celebrate, and we're going to come back bigger and stronger. And I think you're seeing that. And I think this year's race is really going to be an incredible celebration, but I also think it's going to be incredibly emotional for a lot of people.
And as you suggest, you're going to run again, even though you've said to us that you masquerade as a runner. You're not a real marathon runner yourself. You're going to go back and run. It sounds to me like you're excited. Are you going to try to beat your time from last year?
I'm very excited. And last year, that was one of the perfect things, was that, you know, up until everything happened, my goal was a four-hour marathon, and I beat it by 13 seconds, which I probably couldn't cut it that close again if I tried. So going back this year, I mean, I really wanted to run another marathon, and I realized that a couple of months after last year's. You know, I needed to do it because I think it was going to help me heal. You know, running a marathon was such a big thing for me, and it was such a big build-up, and I never got that celebration, and it was kind of, you know, it was a negative memory in my head now. So I said, I have to run another marathon, and I said, it's got to be Boston. So I explored every avenue to do that, whether it was charities or trying to qualify, and I just couldn't do it. There was such high demand for the marathon this year, and the Boston Athletic Association put out a call for people to submit abstracts if they were personally and profoundly impacted by last year's events. So, you know, a few friends had sent that to me, so I said, okay, I'll give it a shot. And, you know, long story short, I told my story in very few words, but said, listen, I know there are many people that were impacted, you know, on a much deeper level than me and my family, but I want to run again. I want to turn this memory into a positive one, and I want to run in support of the BAA and all the incredible things they've done, and I want to run in support of all the victims and all the families. I just want to do it again, and I felt like I had to do it, and thankfully they were receptive to that, and I heard, you know, a few weeks later that I got another exemption, and I'll be running this year. So I'm very excited. And I've made it through the training, so I'm very hopeful I'll have another successful marathon this year.
Well, here's to having a successful marathon and beating your time and getting a chance to celebrate after you're done. Jeff Martin, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jeffrey Martin is an assistant professor of biomedical sciences at Quinnipiac University. He finished the Boston Marathon last year, and he will once again run the race next week. Where We Live is produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives. The executive producer is Katie Talarski. I'm John Dankowski, and this is Where We Live.